dedicate it to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I post a million dirty places.
Piece of junk.
This is dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. Your CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RANs.
Hello and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 1414, March 28th, 2006. I'm Strom Carlson.
I'm Black Ratchet. And this evening we have with us is Dr. Zygmunt again, 2 weeks in a row.
Wow, yeah, I guess I'm just a lucky guy.
Yeah, you're just really cool and everything with the whole getting in there and setting everything up and not having to answer phone calls and that kind of stuff.
You know what I think it really comes down to is I kind of live on IRC, so you kind of just constantly exposed to my banter and you have no choice but to succumb and invite me onto the show.
Exactly, man. Like I tried to get on the show and like I was thinking, man, I can't have Dr. Zygmunt on this week. And then I started going into like Twitches and getting the shoot chills. It was like, oh man. But you're here now, so that's good.
Yeah, sure, whatever.
I guess you could kind of, we have a subtitle over this episode. This is episode 141, When Bad Servers Attack.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. It's like the dreaded VoIPocalypse came about today.
What was 141 in the old KP style, you know,
oh,
KP
yeah,
141.
The routing codes. Let's see. 121 was inward. 131 is directory. I forget what. I think 141 might be rate and root.
Yeah, that sounds right. Hold on. We'll have to actually look
route?
This up.
Are we going to have that fight again?
KP 141 plus start.
ST. So we start at 2600.
Yep, route. Ooh, very good, Strom. You get an A+ this evening.
Yay. So it only follows that we'd be having routing problems tonight, right?
Well, I don't know what the hell was going on. Like, for example, we suddenly couldn't, like, I couldn't dial into the bridge on Strom's computer, and we're going, okay. So I got on the bridge, and then I was going to conference Zygmunt on, and then all of a sudden, new phone was started acting up. Like, your phone did ring, Zygmunt, right?
It did, and then I got a dial tone.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
Yeah, and I couldn't actually use one of my alternate providers because I just didn't have that set up on my phone correctly, which is something I'm going to have to look into. And
It may have to
but
do
we
with
are
the fact
here.
That I just recently upgraded my Asterisk box to 1.2.5, although I don't think that would cause any problems. I mean, it
is
stable after all.
There's a big change from the 1.0 series to the 1.2 series.
Well, yeah, no, but I went from one.
The output on the console.
Yeah, but I was running 1.2.4 last week.
Oh, that's not a big thing, then.
Yeah.
I should have known that you'd be up to date on your Asterisk version.
Screw you all. I'm still running Subversion. They actually fixed the Eeks bug, just in case anyone's curious.
Oh, did they? Okay, good. I can go back to that, then.
Yeah. I was running Bleeding Edge for a while. At least I assume they fixed the Eeks bug. That could be the problem tonight, but...
Well, it wouldn't have gotten to stable, would it?
Well, no. What the weird part is, like, last night I was trying to verify some payphones for Yapple, and the, you know, my Eeks trunks kept on, you know, really getting messed up, so I was like, okay, fine, we'll just, you know, redo it right here, right now, and it seemed to be working fine, so I assumed the bug was fixed, but who knows, maybe it was me again, and all this stuff is causing issues and everything.
Might be.
Maybe we just got lucky.
Well, technically we did get lucky, so thank goodness that we actually got on the air. So,
what did you guys have to spare, like 3 seconds?
15, I believe the song started.
Something like that. I mean, actually what happened was I saw, just before I started the music, I saw the streaming app that goes from my computer out to the hack radio server. I saw it drop and then reconnect.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, whoops, crap. Yeah, I was literally tuning in and making sure that we were, in fact, streaming live, so I didn't have to say, oh, hey, guess what, guys? It's playing last week's episode.
Well, is it Murphy's Law? Anything that can go wrong, Will?
Yeah, something
like
that.
Possible time. Actually, well, since we're talking about Murphy's Law, the Murphy's Law is not whatever can go wrong, Will. That's actually Finagle's Law.
Oh, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Murphy's Law is, I forget the actual text. It's like, if there's one of two ways someone can do something, they'll always do it the wrong way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
According to Murphy's Law, also known as Finagle's Law or Sod's Law, is a popular adage in Western culture which broadly states that things will go wrong in any given situation.
Well, you can't have a chat about Murphy's Law without talking about Occam's Razor at the same time.
That's true.
Everybody saw, what was the movie, Contact?
Yeah, well, the simplest solution tends to be the best one, all other things being equal.
Yeah, gotta have love for all your laws.
Remember, kids, whatever will go wrong can go wrong. Not just a good idea, it's a law.
Exactly.
Are you going to have McGruff say it next?
Only you could take a bite out of
telephony.
Probability statistics.
Statistical probability.
Exactly.
Bad weight routing statistics.
Only you can fundamentally restructure the nature of mathematics. So.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too hard, right? No? Let's not get into that. That'll take 20 minutes.
Yeah,
let's
not even
take that. Cartesian and non-Cartesian mathematics.
Yeah. So, anyway. In housekeeping, despite all the problems we're having right now, I did go to great lengths to set things up well for our toll-free number, which now, when you call it during the show, routes you to Zygmunt if he's answering the phones. And if you call it not during the show, it automatically routes you to our voicemail box. So you can now call us at any time, and it will route you to the correct place based on the hour of the day.
Ooh!
And also, due to popular demand, and by popular demand, I mean I heard three people fetching about it, we have a free world dial-up number now as well.
Oh, what's our free world dial-up number? I hope to include that in the show notes.
Let me see. I put everything up. There's a post on the BinRev forums, actually, under... I made it a sticky under Hacker Media.
Oh, you mean people actually go to the BinRev forums? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
While you're looking that up, our normal call-in is 888-9-BINREV.
Right, and our free world dial-up number is 758-103.
Right.
Oh, six digits. I thought they were up to, like, seven now or something. No, wait.
Yeah, six digits starting with seven.
Yeah, I have a five-digit, I believe.
Yeah, I've got a five-digit, too.
Yeah,
aren't you guys classic?
It's like slash dot user IDs, you know. My user ID is lower than yours, therefore my phallus is larger.
That sums up slash dot pretty well.
Yeah. Our UK call-in, which I assume still works, is 0845-646-0102.
Yeah, and what I actually will do is sometime between now and soon, I'll get us a call-in number that goes directly to our box so I can verify that it works. And I will post that number as well.
Well, yeah, well, you just need to talk to the guy. I think he talked about setting it up directly in or something.
Okay.
Or someone else. Who cares? Anyway, do we have any other housekeeping type things going on?
That I think is it. I'm just relieved that we're actually casting live now.
And you're not the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course this is the week that both, you know, Strom decides to show up 10 minutes before the episode.
Hey, I didn't decide that.
Well, I'm sorry. LA traffic dictated to Strom that he show up 10 minutes before the episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was sidelined enough that I had to show up 15 minutes before the episode, so therefore, like, I couldn't suddenly get on the bridge and I have to pin it on him as soon as he shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, ah.
I was ready though, for the record.
Yeah, you were ready.
Yeah,
Dr. Zygmunt was the most well prepared.
All right.
He gets his BinRev Radio Preparedness Merit Badge.
I only had to do 5 shows. Nice.
Woohoo.
I don't know how many shows I've really done, but isn't that how those merit badges work? You got to do X number of things?
I think so.
Oh, it depends. I'm going to cover it with my vast Boy Scout knowledge here. Eagle Scout, baby, yeah! But anyway. Well, no, you had, like, a requirement, like, you know, do like, you know, X amount of things, or, well, everything had, like, a list of requirements, but some of those requirements are, like, demonstrate 5 ways you can, you know, do, remove someone's spleen in the middle of the woods, or something. It's just stuff like that.
You can do that by rubbing 2 sticks together, right?
I can start a fire by rubbing 2 sticks together.
What about taking out somebody's spleen?
I can't do the spleen thing. I didn't get the spleen removal merit badge there.
Splenectomy merit badge.
Splenectomy. No, what's it? Is that what it is?
A splenectomy? Well, you can attach ectomy onto anything, and it means taking out of or excising.
Yeah.
So, you know,
zygectomy.
What
I'm removing from the episode, the zygectomy.
I can just press the button here and perform a zygectomy, but I wouldn't.
We probably would never be able to get reconnected.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. This it's just like this button on Strom's desk that says "Drop Sigmund." And it has a little post above it saying "No."
No, it looks like the button from War Games. It's like neon red, and it's got yellow and black stripes around it, and
the glass case over it.
Exactly,
right?
The glass case with the key.
Well, that's a very good idea, Joshua.
I actually had like this. I was dumpster diving we're very veering off topic here tonight. I was dumpster diving like back in college, and I found this massive board and had all these buttons on it. It had like, you know, the 2 keys and all like the buttons you could push. And the best we could actually tell it was for like some type of autoclave or mechanical sterilization setup, because we actually found it in the biology lab. But it looked very impressive in my dorm room for a while. Had the 2 keys on either side, and I didn't know if you had to turn them at the same time or whatever. But it had the big red button with the little glass thing over it that you can't press it accidentally. A little molly guard there.
So you were nice and sterile, unlike every other college student.
Yeah. Actually, someone did a study on college floors, and they were actually quite clean.
The floors in, like, college dorm rooms?
Yeah, it was amazing, because they're all usually, because most of the, like, the freshman dorms are tile, or at least the ones that I've been to. So, it's like, you know, dust can't actually get horrible stuff on them.
I wonder if they plan that on purpose. They're like, huh, you know what, it's their first year of college, they're probably going to be doing a lot of drinking, and it's a lot easier to clean up tile.
I'm sure it is.
I bet you somebody somewhere has to think of factors like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or whoever designed that actually be a kind of cool job. Be like, what could go wrong in people's first year? Let's not have any 2-story buildings. And, you know, let's not make the windows wide enough so a couch can sit outside.
Actually, my freshman dorm was...
Your freshman dorm was what?
I guess that's it for...
Did we lose Ratchet? Oh, no.
All right, moving right along. My freshman dorm has since been totally demolished and replaced with a nice fancy one.
Ah, fancy, fancy. Yeah, mine. I haven't been in the dorms yet. Actually, that has not yet been a part of my college experience.
You know, that's actually a good thing. We're not allowed to call them dorms at school. They're residence halls.
You're actually not allowed to call it a dorm?
No, it's a residence hall.
Oh, terrific!
They give you one of those dirty school looks, like, how old are you? 5.
Crazy, crazy. Yeah, I don't know. I think here's a message from Ratchet. What happened? We lost you.
Well, I'll skip ahead and talk about my personal hacking story.
Okay, why don't you do that? I'll try and get Ratchet back.
That sounds like a good idea.
Okay.
See, we were so lucky to get him so close. He just had to go. Anyway, so my personal hacking story, it is going to carry over again. It is about my currently vaporware version of my search engine. It is getting really, really close. I have the crawler. It's all nice and set up. I'm hoping to release... I can't release the entire crawler because it was work for a company, but I want to release just a package of the way that I parse the robots.txt file, and that's something from the robots exclusion protocol, and it's really only relevant to web crawlers and spiders, and it says what they're allowed to crawl and what they're not to. So I'd like to release that as a little library. But the search engine itself is going along. It has it's been brought online, and a couple of people I've given the URL out to because they're going to test for some SQL injection, see if I missed anything. But hopefully next week I'll be able to post in the forums the actual URL, and we'll give everybody a chance to go in there and just see if they can't damage it. So it should be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to finishing that project up. It's been definitely a big learning experience. And there's a huge difference in just, when you really think about it, it sounds like it'd be easy. Like, oh, you know what, we'll just throw a bunch of words into a database and search through them. But you have to consider so many other things. Like, you can't, normally what you would do if you're going to search through a whole bunch of text for a specific string in SQL queries, as long as we're talking about that, specifically for this implementation, I use Postgres. I would have liked to have used Oracle, but, you know, Oracle's expensive, and I don't have that. So anyway, normally what you do is like a likes search, and what that'll do is it slow as anything, and it searches the full text of everything as you're going through. But it's criminally inefficient. So what I'm using is what's called the T-Search Vectors, and that is a plugin. It's in the contrib directory of the Postgres download, if you download the full source code. But what's nice about the T-Search is it actually stems and stops as it's going through. What that means is as you're indexing pages, it takes out A's and the's and is and all those little words that would just make the query take longer. And it stems, meaning if you have, what are two words? Well, you know you have words that end in ing, that can also end in ed, you know, suffixes, things like that. They all get pulled off, and so that you just have a cache of the actual word itself. Now, when you do an actual search, you can't just search this special created T-search forum or table. It's actually a column in a table. But you can't just search it with a normal like or anything. You also have to use the T-search vectors again. So we go ahead, and that's tons of fun. And, you know, the relevance isn't quite perfect. It needs to be tuned a lot more. I think what I'm going to do is put more weight to the value of the text that's actually in the URL or in the title. But I didn't really think about that in advance, and that's why it's always important to make sure you have a really good design out for what you're going to do. But I think that would really help relevance. If anybody else has any good ideas, if anybody's ever, you know, researched or worked like that, because I'm not really a database programmer. I just like to mess around with everything, I guess. It's a great way to learn everything that's out there, so just to try new things. So that's what's going on with my search engine. Hopefully soon we'll get that out. And hopefully soon we'll get the rest of the crew back on. Oh, is that what we hear?
Would that be Ratchet?
Oh, yes. Connie?
Boy, the Gremlins are out tonight.
All right. Just as I ran out of stuff to say.
That's pretty good. Thank you, Zygmunt, for carrying the show like that. You might have a future in radio.
That's what I could do.
I'm going to need a shot of liquor or something after all this. Jesus.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. Well, we've moved on to the more reliable semi-cell phone landline. So,
well,
shall we go into the email?
Yeah, let me see if I can bridge that music in. Hold on.
If not, we may just, you know, should we just start reading email and not tempt the gods at this point?
Let's try it. Our first email is from Cyprus, and he says, I was just sitting in school where my buddy installed Tor, and I was wondering if it would be possible to run a massive man-in-the-middle attack on Tor. Is that possible? Could you just run FragRouter and or similar programs and just collect user data and passwords using the SSL dump? Keep up the great work on the show, guys. P.S. I'm the guy that emailed you before about the weird chemistry teacher and the Yugo. +++ Cyprus.
I actually wonder if it's +++ Cyprus or just pronounced Cyprus or... Double cross Cyprus.
Well,
double cross Cyprus. That actually sounds great.
Double plus or double cross, yeah. You answer the email, I'm getting some alcohol.
No, sounds like a good plan to me. That's what I should have done when I got my cell phone. I was right in the kitchen. Anyway, I actually was thinking about this for a while, and then I decided, hey, let's go actually consult the Tor fact. And the Tor fact states, Every Tor server has a public decryption key rotated once a week. When Tor clients establish circuits, at each step they demand the Tor server prove knowledge of its private key. That way the first node in the path can't just boost the rest of the path. How do clients know that what the servers are, and how do they know that they have the right keys for them? The directory servers provide a signed list of all the approved servers, and that list are set as a set of self-signed certificates from each server, specifying their keys, locations, exit policies, and so on. So unless the adversary can control a directory server, and starting in Tor 011X, a threshold of directory servers, he can't trick the Tor client into using other Tor servers. How do clients know what directory servers are? The list comes with Tor distribution and hard codes their locations and their public keys. So the only way to trick the user into using a fake Tor network is to give them a specially modified version of the software. So Double Cross Cypress or whatever your name is, it's about impossible. I would assume that the EFF is kind of sticky on this whole privacy issue thing, so they probably have some of the best and the brightest people working on it. So I would think it would be kind of secure, but, you know, who knows.
The Tor's only real competition to security is against a global adversary. And that is an adversary who has large control or the ability to sniff large parts of the network. Because if they can see you going into a traffic node, and they can also see traffic coming out from another node, they can't prove that it was you, but if they happen to see a large enough part of the network and it just so happens that every time something comes in from you, something happens to go out from somewhere else, and they can correlate the times, they could actually sniff your traffic because it's going to come out unencrypted unless, of course, there's some sort of encryption going on like you're using SSH or SSL. But Tor has been a pretty damn good product, especially since it's free.
It's free!
Free!
Yeah. Tor is good. I would think that would be kind of secure, and they'd probably take into attacks like this. But I think we had an episode on Tor that Zygma was on, now that I think of it.
We did.
So, I mean, we talk about it there, and if you also want, look at last week's episode. We talked about SSH and public versus private key encryption, and that gives you a few, it gives you a sort of a hint of what they're up against. So, either way, Tor is secure. Well, I wouldn't say Tor is not completely secure. When you start it up, it tells you right there, do not use for strong anonymity. But you know, I think you're pretty good for normal web browsing. Next email.
All right, our next email. Now that I've got some rum in me. Hey, Strom and Black Ratchet. You mentioned polyphasic sleep at the beginning of your show. Actually, it says at the beginning of your show, but whatever. I would not recommend that any of your listeners actually try this as a way of getting more time in the day off for hacking. It's true that people who are sleep-deprived either REM fairly quickly or enter REM fairly quickly. However, REM is not the only important phase of sleep. For example, REM is not the only stage of sleep associated with dreaming, and dreaming in all stages of sleep has been found to be extremely important for learning and memory. If you do want to hack your sleep, you might want to try using it to improve your ability to learn new tasks. For example, if you're working on some code and come to a bug that seems unfixable, try taking a nap and then coming back to it. While you're asleep, your brain might come up with a solution you never thought you could think of. The brain is funny like that. Works the same for playing video games, doing logic puzzles, studying for tests, etc. Peace, Mystic.
Well, Mystic, thanks for your... I'm curious if you actually, whether or not you've actually done polyphasic sleep. And I'm curious as to whether or not we actually have someone who listens that does or has done or actually has some experience with polyphasic sleep and what their take on it was, as it were. But interesting observation. I wasn't actually completely aware of that. Personally, with your whole on your second thing, you're going away and taking a nap while trying to munch on a large problem. My experience is that if I walk away from a tough problem, you know, whether I sleep or not. And when I come back to tackle it again, you know, a new solution that I hadn't really thought of usually presents itself. Not all the time, of course, but I think it's less of a matter, or at least for me, it could be, you know, different, you know, folks could have different things. But for me, I guess it's less of a matter of taking a rest from the constant nonstop thinking about the problem rather than actually just, like, taking a nap. Like, my case in point, I mean, today, you know, for those of you who don't know, I'm usually on, you know, IRC Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. I'm not always on there, but I'm usually logged in and I'm, you know, reading the mail at least. I mean, if you're on there from 9 to 5, you'll often see me, you know, pop in for a bit and then suddenly leave for, like, a large extended period of time. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, the reason behind this is, you know, I'm taking a break. I'm trying to, you know, stop thinking about the problem, whatever I'm chewing on at the moment, and then I come back to tackle it. And it usually works. Since we're on the talking about hacking your sleep and all that stuff, I'm curious if the old stories of, you know, listening to stuff while you sleep, you know, listening to Spanish while you sleep, and you'll learn Spanish and while you're taking a nap, are actually true. And I'm actually curious if any listeners have had experience with that.
Sí, está muy bien.
Do you speak in Spanish or they learn through sleep learning?
I think I just said yes. It uses very well. So obviously my Spanish is off.
Oh. I don't know. I'm on GSM, so it's all sounds horrible.
Yeah, it sounds horrible on this end too, anyway.
Well, the whole polyphasic thing, you know, the whole polyphasic sleep, of course you should never actually, like, do anything that we talk about on the radio show, because it's really just something that we all kind of get together and do for fun. So, of course, never, you know, I guess insert disclaimer, you know, speak with your doctor. But I have heard a lot of mixed reviews on the whole polyphasic sleep subject. And one site that has a lot of really good information about it, it's a blog from somebody who actually has successfully made his transition. He talks about where he had trouble and why he thinks it's better and why he thinks it's not as good. And it doesn't only have his point of view, it has the point of view of his wife as well and how it's like to live with somebody who's changed their sleep style. The guy's name is Steve, and I'm going to butcher the last name. It's Pavlina, P-A-V-L-I-N-A. Please accept my apologies.
Pavlina. Steve Pavlina.
And I tiny URL'd it. It's tinyurl.com/AALXK. Whatever that is in fancy talk.
Alpha, lima, x-ray,
kilowatt.
But it's just something, if you are seriously considering it, you should check out that blog, and I'll tell you more about it. So, if somebody was taking it seriously.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Zygmunt.
Oh, I'm done. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think Zygmunt actually brought up a very important point, actually, not never to take the show seriously, and we don't know what the hell we're doing, so...
Yes. For entertainment purposes only.
Yes. If you ever think you know what we're doing, or you think we know what we're doing, pop on the IRC, talk to a good man, his name is Theoxy, and ask him what he thinks of the show, so... I mean, earlier in the IRC, he was saying that we had a contentectomy, so...
A content what? A contentectomy?
Yeah, a contentectomy. But he always complains about our apparent lack of content.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we had some technical difficulties today, so I think that's to be excusable. And we haven't even gotten to the good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was actually before our issues, so he's probably like, you know, probably ran off when I dropped. But anyway, who's our next email from? Magnum IP?
Our next email is, yeah, from Magnum IP. And, let's see, he says... Oh, before we go on, I should probably say that, like, this past week or two, I've been sleeping kind of a few hours in the afternoon, a few hours during the day. It sucks major balls. I prefer my solid 8 hours.
From sleeping method.
Yeah. So, anyway, Magnum IP writes, "Hey guys, I called in on one of your live shows when you were asking people to call in and talk about pretty much anything. I ranted about how the new WRT54G.V.5 VXWorks firmware is horrendous. I also ranted on Verizon installing Fios in my whole neighborhood but my street. Well, after numerous calls to the main office, they admitted to a computer error stating it was reported that the cables were ready to get laid and everything was ready for Fios service on my street when in fact it wasn't. Verizon is sending engineers out to start the work in a week or two. Can't wait to get my Astros box finally installed and working with 15 megabit down and 2 megabit up. Damn you. I also have a gripe about a certain ISP in my area about their policies on password retrieval. My friend forgot her password to her new email address from her new DSL account she got from a local telco. She never used it because she's still using AOL for her email. Well, as an experiment, I emailed the ISP asking for my password from her AOL email address. After about 2 days, I sent the password in a reply without confirming any information or asking to call the 800 number to talk to a live operator to verify information. In my mind, that's a very big no-no. Shame on this local telco. Thanks for your time. Magnum IP. P.S. Strom is my secret love monkey.
Strom, I had no idea.
Yeah, neither did I.
Huh. They must do it while you're sleeping for those 3 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Well, first off, congratulations on getting your fiber to the premises. I refuse to recall it. Their little, whatever they call it, Fios, or... did that even actually stand for anything? It's probably like fiber over or something, I don't know.
I don't know yet, I'll look.
No, anyway. I'll get fiber to the premises from Verizon whenever they remove their asinine filtering policies and allow me to get a static IP address without giving them my firstborn son.
Fios, according to Wikipedia, stands for Fiber Optic Services.
Tricksy hobbuses. So yeah, now we all know. I'm currently using their DSL now, and I think the contract's going to expire in next January, and I'm going to jump ship day after it goes out. I already have like two or three ISPs lined up, and me going to call them immediately afterwards and saying, "Set it up, do it now."
Yeah, I've got 6 megabit DSL here in California from a company called DSL Extreme. Love them. No restrictions, no filtering whatsoever. Cheap, too.
Well, apparently, like, COVAD doesn't have my CO, so I'm like, what the... It sucks. But there's a small... It looks like there's a small mom-and-pop on Cape Cod, which is a... For those of you unfamiliar with Massachusetts, Cape Cod, if you've ever seen a picture of Massachusetts, it's that little hook that sort of goes out onto the east part of the state.
It's Massachusetts Wang.
Yeah. They can't have Florida. That's United States Wang. Or America's Wang, whatever they call it. But anyway, like, you know, there's a small mom-and-pop ISP called, like, CapeCod.net, and they actually have rather good service and reasonable prices, so I think I'm going to have to hop over to them if... Speakeasy or COVAD, or it's COVAD who does Speakeasy, and I think they also do their DSL Extreme. It doesn't start on my CO. Personally, I can't stand having a filter in place. I had Speakeasy before. It was wonderful. They gave me, like, you know, killer speeds. Their customer support was very clueful, and I have literally, like, little to no complaints about them. Like, maybe one, but other than that, it was absolutely fine. So I just can't. I've experienced the Rolls Royce. I refuse to go back to the Pinto. Personally, your statement of a very big no-no is is the understatement of the century regarding the password policy. I'm kind of disappointed that you didn't kind of drop the name of the ISP, so, you know, people that are looking for ISPs in your areas can stay the hell away from it. Although I guess if they kind of handed out passwords, that would be a smart thing not to drop their name, because everyone would be like, "Oh, I need my password."
Well, everyone could just jump ship immediately, so.
Well, no, because, no. Well, I mean, all the smart people would if they actually got out there, but none of the regular people would.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you really need to contact someone about that. That's, like, you know, very, very dangerous and very, very stupid. Find your ISP security officer. If it's a small ISP, of course, you also use the term telco, so that's a bit annoying. It could be actually a telephone company, which at which point you're screwed. At that point, you may want to talk to your local newspaper. That really is a security breach waiting to happen. So, yes, contact somebody, you know, find an adult, go tell them, at which point afterwards when they look at you funny, you know, find the security officer or find the local news outlet. So, yeah, that's about it. You know, this issue needs to address. You shouldn't be sending passwords over the email no matter what. I mean, even if you have to verify who it is. I mean, I'm never a fan of sending out passwords in plain text over email. So, fix it. This is your job. Go do it. We want a full report. Go take your 15 megabit bandwidth and go do something useful with it.
All right.
Our next email is from Tioxy.
Is it?
Amazing. Yes, he is.
Ah, okay.
Actually, I think he used his name, but we're not going to actually, we're just going to actually point to out fact out that he emailed the show.
Gas. No wonder we're having technical difficulties tonight. Hell is freezing over. Pigs are flying.
Amazing.
Anyway.
The email is, that's the liquor talking. The book you're thinking of is Firewalls and Internet. He left out an is. The book you're thinking of is Firewalls and Internet Security by Cheswick and Belevin. The story was a paper Belevin published, and isn't the only free material in the book. There's also the paper There Be Dragons, which discusses a related topic. The paper is available at tinyurl.com/RomeoLimaMikeEcho4. I also had a question about... What?
Very good. You actually got all right. Amazing.
Yeah, I'm learning my alphabets. LOL Internet. I also had a question about user mode Linux. If you use raw sockets in user mode Linux, how is that implemented if you are running as root? Can't you use that facility to determine with fair likelihood if you're in UML?
You know, I've done some socket programming, and, you know, if you're not root and you try to open a raw socket, I'm pretty sure you get an error, and the error you get is error proto no support, which is the protocol not supported. And I could totally be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that that's also the reason why if you try to run nmap and you do certain tests when you're not root, it'll tell you you can't run that test unless you're super user. And that's not something I'm 100%, so don't take that to the bank, but I'm pretty sure that if you try to open that socket as root, any raw socket as root, you're going to get that error no prot support error.
I actually submitted this question to a couple people that I know, and they were all scratching their heads. So at this point, I am not going to be able to answer this. However, I will get an answer. Kioxy was very kind and actually emailed us last week. However, he had the unfortunate mishap of being between two pieces of spam. So,
ouch.
So he sort of blended into the background. But I need to do some research into this, and I actually want to try this because this is a very good question. However, if someone actually does know the answer, just feel free to email us at radio@binrev.com. So, congratulations, Tioxy. You have stumped BIMREV Radio. I'm sure you're very giddy about this, and we'll put it on your resume.
We should send him a trophy. You've stumped BIMREV Radio.
We'd have to be giving out a lot of trophies.
Yeah, no, tell me about it.
Everybody's got us beat on something.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go into show and tell. Dr. Zygmunt, what have you been working on this week?
You know, I believe I've already told this story.
Yeah, he
while you were MIA.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He pulled it out of nowhere and used wonderful filler while we tried to get you back on the...
I earned my mutant ability of the filibuster.
The Democrats will want you. You go run for Senate. Well, what have you been doing then? If Dr. Zygmunt's already blown his load.
What have I been doing? Jeez. Apart from battling with Asterisk and my desktop machine.
That was only like 15 minutes. So, you know, what else did you do this week?
Nothing major to speak of, I think. Just yeah.
Fun in the sun.
Yeah, fun in, well, it should be sun here in Southern California, but it's not. Rain and more miserable rain.
Aww. Poor Strom. He's scared of his usual rain. He doesn't like the cloudiness.
Oh, I'm not scared of it. It's just, it made my commute home today 2 hours.
Personally, you know, in at least the... at least in Boston, when it rains, the commute's always 2 hours. So, hey, what do I know? What have I been doing? Let's see. I've been data mining for work, and you've actually, if you've been in IRC, you've been hearing me complain about this software that I've been trying to use. Basically, we've had this software sitting around, this highly expensive piece of software. This software quite literally cost about $10,000. And it's used to data mine two separate databases, and I'm doing this for work, and it's nothing, you know, gray area, illegal, slightly immoral. It's completely fine. It's basically, we're looking at dead people, so it's a matter of public record and all that wonderful stuff. Either way.
Dead people.
Yeah. I've been seeing dead people. I've been seeing dead people all week, last week as well. So the software package, we'll just sort of, it's actually owned by IBM now. It's gone through like two or three different company ownerships since we got it. It's called Integrity Designer, and it sucks. Don't use it. Of course, no one will actually use it because it costs $10,000. And after banging my head against the software for, I'd say about a week, I finally sat down and I wrote a bunch of Perl scripts out that basically replicated exactly what it did. And I think the only slight advantage that it has is that it's slightly faster. And I think if I probably actually sat down, worked out some threading into these Perl scripts, it would give it a very good run for its money. But, you know, the software to which we've paid, you know, $10,000 to initially buy, and then a, like, you know, 3 or 4 year service contract that my predecessor recommended at work for like $5,000 a year. We've plucked down, like, you know, a good chunk of change about this. And I've written in about a week software that basically emulates a good majority of its functions. And I actually feel kind of proud about that.
They should have just given you the $10,000.
God, that would be great.
That'll be the day.
No, it doesn't work that. It doesn't work like that. Hell no. But yes, that's what I've been doing, and I'm sick and tired of looking at statistics, and I think I set up for a nice little, you know, batch run tonight, and hopefully when I stroll in tomorrow morning, I'll be able to wash my hands.
Fail on the first query.
No. I actually did a couple of dry runs on it, so I know it was at least
okay.
We're knock on wood right now because you brought it up.
You know what's really surprising? You know what's going on? People are logging into the IRC channel to tell us things.
Well, let's say that. People have done that before.
Yeah, but like surprisingly a lot tonight. So just to answer you guys, yes, we know we're having technical difficulties and we know there's echo. Please stop telling us.
But we do appreciate you telling us.
Yes, we do appreciate you
initially.
Pointing it out initially, but now that we're totally aware of it, thanks, we know. And to Eggman, who logged in to say, tell Strom to quit bitching about the rain, it's been raining for 38 days here. I totally sympathize with you, but still, Jesus Christ, rain, no.
And actually, it's not me echoing. I believe it's actually Dr. Zygmunt, but we won't get into that because it was echoing before he got on the cell phone.
Yeah.
I'm not on the cell phone. How about that?
Whatever. Who cares? We'll run some digital technical jiggly pokery over it later in the archives, so no one ever will be listening to the archives going, I don't hear an echo.
God. I hope I can do that.
Shush.
Actually, the echo's worse now. Can you drop, Zygmunt? I'll call you again.
Okay.
Okay, check. Yeah, it was him, okay.
Aha. All these horrible people. Anyway, while Strom's telling it, our show topic tonight is bioinformatics. Actually, I think it's bioinformatics. That's how I pronounce it. It could be bioinformatics for all I know. And actually, the reason why we have Zygmunt on the show tonight is because this is what Zygmunt actually goes to school for, which is amazing, and it's actually kind of inconvenient because he's not here right now. But, what bioinformatics is. Basically, bioinformatics is it's computational biology, and what it does is it involves the use of, you know, applied mathematics, informatics, statistics, and computer science, and they all, you know, tie them together with chewing gum and tape and all that wonderful stuff, and they use it to solve biological problems. Like, we'll go into, like, what these actual biological problems are, because Zygmunt can actually speak for this a lot better than I can with the actual applications uses. I've been kind of fooling around with it because that's actually one of the applications that the state of mind and compassion that I have has use for. That's what they kind of pimp it out as. But we won't actually. I don't touch it, and I have no clue about it, and it won't actually do it. But computational biology research often overlaps with, you know, systems biology. major efforts in the field of gene sequencing alignments, gene findings, genome assembly. For those of you who don't remember, back in 2000, the genome project where they mapped an entire Sigmund, what did they actually map? They mapped the human genome project
where they actually sequenced. They didn't map, but they sequenced the entire genome. They're still sequencing it now. Or, I'm sorry, they're still mapping it now. And by mapping, we mean being able to identify this sequence is for this gene, this sequence is for this gene, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so basically I've told everyone that is it bioinformatics or informatics?
I think that's tomato, tomato.
Okay.
Well, you wrote...
I like
whoever wrote cool this up wrote definition.
Huh?
Whoever wrote this up wrote web definition instead of web definition, so...
Hey, okay, yeah, well, that's why I'm a biology major and not an English major.
And I'm a social science major, so...
Go step off to the side there and, go do your spelling Nazi in silence.
Woot.
Yes. So, okay, well, Zygmunt, you could probably explain, like I was telling everyone, this is what you go for school for, right?
Well, I'm a biology, I'm actually a triple major, which is biology, computer science, and chemistry. But I do plan to be a doctor. And bioinformatics is something that I was definitely looking in because it combines not only excellent job opportunities for somebody who is thinking, maybe what do I want to do with my life, but it also allows you to really do work that's going to make a big difference in people's lives. And really, bioinformatics is becoming such a huge field that daily, we'll talk about some of the databases later, but researchers are using these to save thousands and thousands of hours of sequencing things themselves in the lab. And it's really just the sheer amount of data that's involved is requiring such advanced programming that anybody who really wants to take a leap and get into this sort of work can have a really good job for a really long time. And I'm not sure exactly what we said so far, but if you want to start the ball rolling, we'll go from there.
I talked about what it all involves. It's sort of like computational biology. It involves all mathematics and informatics, statistics, and all that stuff. But if you want to take it up from there, you're much of a much more about this than I do. And actually, the first question that I have is, if you become a doctor, are you going to have to change your handle to call you Dr. Zygmunt?
Well, that's why everybody is always saying, oh, are you really a doctor? Rah, 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 rah. Well, that's the idea, so that I'm only going to have to be like, yeah, it really is doctor. So that's part of the whole handle, where that comes from. But I guess if we're going to get back to bioinformatics, probably the first thing that we should talk about, it's not entirely computer-related, but the first thing we should talk about is just DNA. And one of the major uses for bioinformatics is the major indexes that are maintained of genetic sequences. Probably the largest that's out there goes by the name of GenBank. And that is maintained by the National Institute of Health. But, I wish I would have written it down because I have the URL. I have a tiny URL, but I don't have the actual URL. But if you want to actually search GenBank, it's free and open to anybody. You can get it at tinyurl.com/YS7FB. And what that basically is a search engine of basically the Human Genome Project and other assorted gene sequences. And you as a researcher can input into it a sequence of bases, of nucleotides, and we're going to tell what that is in just a second. And with that, you can get any matching sequences that exist, where they exist, what species they exist, and what's the difference between that specific sequence in various species. So anyway, for anybody who, it's been a while out of high school to talk about DNA, it's a deoxyribonucleic acid. We've all seen the pretty picture of the two spirals going up with the chain.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, of course, there's the four bases of DNA, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And that's what you see in all these gene banks, A, T, G, and C. That's where it comes from. It's those four bases. And they bind selectively A to T and G to C. Of course, there's reasons and times when that gets violated, but that's not important for our discussion. And it's the sequence of the bases that form the template for the transcription of the actual sequence of DNA code into RNA, which is ribonucleic acid, And what RNA does is that codes actually for protein. The RNA itself is then copied, and amino acids are put together, and you're going to have a protein. That protein is now going to be the actual phenotype. So basically, the whole mantra we're trying to get to here is first DNA, RNA, protein. When you have a change in the DNA, it's going to change the RNA, and it'll change the final outcome, the final protein. And what they're doing with a lot of the bioinformatics is they can predict, okay, if we change this part of a protein, this is going to happen. Some people have seen the, what's the major protein folding that's out there? Oh, protein folding at home.
Folding at home, yeah.
Folding at home, that's exactly, and that's not exactly the same thing, but that's kind of, it's in the same realm. It's a little bit more physics related, but you could almost consider that bioinformatics. It's really any use of computers to handle the massive amount of data that's really affiliated with life.
Okay. So just before anyone gets the wrong idea, we're not talking, we're talking about DNA here, but we're not talking that we're suggesting that people resequence their own DNA. You know, because we're talking about sleep last week, and people were thinking that we're, you know, endorsing polyphasic sleep here, and I just want to get that out in the open and make sure no one's going to be doing it. So we don't want to have, basically we're going to have like a bunch of like little kids like, you know, Island of Dr. Moreau.
Which is always cool.
Yeah. Little Timmy, I resequenced his DNA, and he's now a five-ass monkey.
Five-ass. But I'm sure what it comes down to is what is all this data really used for?
Yeah.
And really what it comes down to, a perfect example is a researcher. They have a segment of some sort of DNA. It has a specific sequence, and they want to know where the sequence appears in the entire sequence, where it appears in the genetic map. They want to know if their specific sequence is mutated slightly. You know, like maybe I have a T where I'm supposed to have an A. Something like this can, like GenBank, can look through it. You can feed it a sequence of 50 A's, T's, G's, and C's, and it'll find the closest sequence matches to it. You can see maybe you have something that's mutated, maybe you have something from a different species, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can bring this into a little bit more of the real-world applications. You have something that's called a restriction endonuclease, and that's a really fancy word to say a pair of scissors that cuts DNA. It always cuts it at a specific point, which is a specific sequence. You know, it'll always cut it ATGG. They're usually palindromic sequences, so I'm trying to remember ATGC. Okay, think of it the same way forwards and backwards. Great. But what you end up with is, let's say you're a researcher, and you're going to use this specific restriction endonuclease to cut your sample of DNA. It would probably be helpful to know if that sequence also appears in the middle of your DNA, wouldn't it? So that you don't end up cutting what you want to study in half?
That would kind of suck.
Totally. So what you can do is you can turn to GenBank and say, hey, in this sequence, I'm trying to determine what gene this is. I think this might be BRCA1, which is breast cancer gene 1. I want to study that. So what's the exact sequence for that? It'll pop up,
wait,
you know.
What do they call it? BRCA1?
Oh, BRCA1.
BRCA1, right?
Yeah, BRCA1. And that's one of the genes that's linked to breast cancer.
Huh.
But,
okay,
you know...
Okay, well, I mean, this always confused me. Like, from the beginning when they're talking about, we mapped everything. I mean, they mapped all of the genes. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, they haven't actually mapped all the genes, and they don't know the function of every gene and every protein.
Okay, they took somebody's DNA and they mapped all the genes on it, right?
They took the sequence, and they were able to break down the sequence into its collections of A's, T's, G's, and C's.
Okay, but also at the same point, I mean, my collection of DNA is unique, and it's not going to be, say, for example, you know, exactly matching their collection of DNA. So what use does this actually serve?
It's not that the genetic difference between two humans is really, in the grand scheme of things, it's minuscule. The genetic difference between a human and a primate, a monkey, is only, there's a 99% correlation. You know, 99% of the sequences are pretty much exactly the same. So there is going to be difference between human to human. And they actually did have a paper, I wish I could recall exactly where they got the DNA for the human Genome Project, but it's such a small, like the only differences that you're going to have is you have boy or girl, of course you're going to have an X or a Y, you're going to have that extra. You know, there are subtle differences, of course, you know, eye color, And everything that makes everybody look slightly different is going to be a result of their genetic code, the phenotypes, the proteins that are produced. But a lot of that, with bioinformatics, they're starting to catalog those differences. Why is it that you have brown eyes versus green? You know, what is the exact change in the genetic code that's causing that? And something like that is very useful for, let's say, that there's also a degenerative ocular disorder that's causing cancer. Okay? Huh. But now we can look at that exact gene sequence and say, hey, you know what? We see this correlation between people who have blue eyes and higher incidence of cancer, for instance. Maybe there's something to do with the genetic sequence, so they can look up that genetic sequence and they can see what's different. They can experiment that on the lab, and they can get they have the ability to access this exact sequence. When 20 years ago, if they wanted to do any sort of research like this, it was millions of dollars to be able to build the libraries of genes, and you know, you'd have to try different restriction endonucleases to try to get the right sequence. But with this, you can look it up. It's at a couple of clicks. Oh, wait, there's a T here instead of a G. I wonder what a difference that makes. Let's see how that folds as a protein. They can put that into a computer. Granted, they have to be rather complicated computers, really sophisticated, but that's why this is such an emerging market.
Right, yeah, you're not going to be running this on your, you know, 386 laptop from 1992. This is going to require something pretty beefy.
Yeah, but you know, even those little computers help. Just look at protein or the folding at home. They're just breaking it up in a little work unit.
Oh, yeah. It's all very fascinating stuff.
Well, just wide area distributed computing is just cool anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, a question I have for you, Zygmunt, and I don't know if I missed this because I was busy trying to get the stream working correctly, and I guess it's not really working. But my question for you is, like, of the actual, I mean, I know they've got the thing mapped out. As far as the actual sequencing goes, they've got a sequence, but like, how many of the genes do they actually have, like, really mapped out now, and how many do they still have left to go?
You know, I really can't quote a specific number.
Roughly.
I wish I could.
Like, roughly.
You know, I really can't even make an educated guess as to the number that has been sequenced. I know if you talk about different species, like if you look, one of the most used animals for genetic research is Drosophila.
Yeah.
Is the fruit fly, and that entire, it's only 4 chromosomes. Every gene has been sequenced. They know exactly what every single gene does.
Mm-hmm.
They know where it is on the chromosome, and they know if it's altered like this, this will happen. If it's altered like that, that'll happen. They could talk about the inheritance and all that. But, you know, I can't give that exact number for the Human Genome Project. I know they're definitely making leaps and strides. And it's a huge area of research because it really is. You get into the future of what's going to be medicine, and you're going to start coming away from all the different drugs and the different substances. Well, there's so many bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. There are so many disorders that are genetic in nature. It's going to start getting to a point where we're going to be using genetic engineering to cure disease on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not quite there yet, and we're looking at a lot of immunological cures for different disorders. Main one, because I hate to keep bringing it up and harping on it, but really cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Cancer is going to be so difficult to treat because it's different in every person. And now as we're doing it real quick, the reason that cancers are different is because they result from mutations. You have to have at least 5 mutations in 5 different genes in order for a cell to revert to a cancerous state. So it's going to grow uncontrollably. You know, and that's why when you hear about people saying, "Oh, he has a increased risk of breast cancer," or not he.
Well,
no,
men, some men can get breast cancer as well. I seem to recall that.
They do.
No, it's not truly breast cancer. It's cancer that's in the breast area, but it's some other form of cancer.
Right.
Breast cancer. I actually had a job that used to deal with this, and breast cancer can only be occurring in women because it's because I actually had to format all of these reports and everything, and when you were talking about breast cancer, you didn't want to try to calculate out the male because there was no data on that. So
take that, Susan G. Komen.
Yeah. Just along the lines of you didn't want to calculate out testicle cancer for the females because there was going to be no data.
I don't recall that it being actually zero. I thought it was a very, very small percentage, but I'll yield to you on this one.
Well, I don't. If I remember correctly, it's not you. I mean, a man can get cancer in his breast area, but it's actually not breast cancer as the actual terminology goes.
In the same tissues, I'm sure.
I mean, yeah, because I believe breast cancer has to be within the mammary tissue of the female. And we're completely drifting off topic here, so yeah.
Back to bioinformatics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the crux of the argument for bioinformatics is that it's such a lot. There's so much data to be processed. You look at the human genome; it's absolutely gigantic. You're talking about between 20,000 to 30,000 genes, and each gene can be anywhere from 100 bases up to 100,000 plus bases.
And, how much storage are we talking about?
Well, GenBank, for one, has cataloged one gigabase of data, which is, think a gigabyte, and now you have gigabase, and it's gotten to the matter, and that's just on genetic sequences.
Oh,
we could be talking about any other.
Are all their bases are belong to them?
All their bases are belong to them.
Oh, God, there's a T-shirt, right? There's a... Do a DNA strand or something, and then have all your base R belong to me.
That's a new shirt that you guys should come up
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
It'll be cut with all the biology majors.
Yes.
You can have Watson and Crick on the shirt saying all your base R belong to
That's
us.
It.
To
That's
us.
The shirt, right?
Okay, so, I mean, so a gigabase, so that means like...
A billion bases, right?
Yeah.
If that's what that is, I guess that,
yeah, a billion base pairs.
Yeah, I couldn't remember how much it was.
So, and that's just one database. But I mean, GenBank does it does take its data from several different locations. A couple of them being the DNA Data Bank of Japan, the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, and GenBank at the National Center for Biotechnology Information. So there's more than one database out there, and GenBank just happens to be a search engine that will crawl through all these different ones. And GenBank stands out because that's the one they really educate students about. It's really the easiest to use, and you can still get a whole lot of information. And it's the same thing that researchers are using. We're talking people who have their PhDs and beyond, people who are working on their Nobel Prizes.
Hmm. When are you going to get your Nobel Prize?
That's exactly what I want to know. When am I going to get my Nobel Prize? I don't even want the money. I just want the prize. So I could be like, my friends are going to come over and say, oh, yes, this is my kitchen. This is my dining room, my Nobel Prize. I mean, you got to get chicks if you have a Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, baby, want to check out my medal?
I'd be like, ooh. But there's also some information on the hardware that's used, or actually, rather, before the hardware. I know they're using a lot of different scripting languages for stuff like that. What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, I was looking into this, and apparently there's a fair share of, like, regular languages that are actually being used in this. Like, I mean, I actually knew that Perl was, was actually used a lot in, like, gene sequences, but I actually had no clue what actually it is. But what really shocked me is actually, well, twofold, because people actually use Python, but what shocked me more was people were actually using Python for this type of stuff, which was, I mean, Perl and Python, yes, can do a lot of things, but I did not expect it to actually get involved with gene sequencing and various other forms of, biology type stuff. I mean, I just use it as a data munging language, but I guess when you're dealing with, gobs and gobs and gobs of data, it's a good thing. Perl, Python, they're often used to, interface with the actual databases and parse outputs from the various programs. However, it's actually interesting because Linux is actually used in open source software. Is used a lot in this stuff. Like, communities of, bioinformatics programmers have set up projects. Like, there's a couple of them that I just, quickly want to rattle off here. MBOSS, M-B-O-S-S, Bioconductor, BioPerl, BioLinux, BioPython, BioRuby, and BioJava. I wonder where they get these names from. I don't know. And what they do is they distribute shared programming tools and objects and file libraries that try to make bioinformatics easier. And I actually found this cool article on O'Reilly about Perl and bioinformatics, and it's http://tinyurl.com/NovemberQuebecJuliet. Sorry, I've got a stuffy nose all of a sudden. November Quebec Juliet 2 Echo. It's just this. I knew it's been a while since we actually had a clunker of an episode, but I guess this is, guess all good things must come to an end. Actually, what really found cool is that I found a integrated software workbench, and it actually has a lot of these tools described already, and it's called, I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, VigYannCD, VigYannCD. And it has all these tools, and in itself it's an open source bioinformatics workbench. And it's apparently it's quite complete. I mean, I looked at it, and I saw a nice like okay, but apparently people are raving about it. If you actually do some googling it, and it's available at vigyancd.org, two A's.
They do also have a full Linux live CDs that are being used for this exact purpose, and something that's built into a lot of them is the ability to do distributed computing.
Well, yeah, that's what part of it is, and this program is actually part of a grid package, so you can do your own little miniature grid computing. It's cool, but like I'm looking at it and going, oh, I have no clue what the hell all this stuff is. So I guess it's more along the lines of if you know exactly how to use the tools. This is actually good, but yeah, I'm just kind of like, you know, going at it and saying, well, this looks impressive, but I actually have no idea actually how to use it.
You can sequence DNA in the comfort of your own home.
Woohoo!
Yeah, no,
you can make all the searches on, especially GenBank. GenBank's really heavily used. You can, you know, just for kicks, you can throw in a couple of sequences and see what, it'll actually tell you the difference between, like, the relevance, you know, like, percent match. You see if maybe two proteins are going to interfere with each other. So.
Well, actually, I did a search on that URL that you give, and I did a search for boobies, and I was like, you know, 25 hits came up, so.
Hey,
I was like, all right, good for them.
Hey, even biology majors need to have a daily dose.
Apparently so. All right, so since we're already talking about software, you know, like, this is good for my own little home PC, but I assume that these giant pieces that are trying to, you know, sequence the entire human genome have a slightly better hardware than my, you know, Athlon 1.7 gigahertz computer. At least I would hope. Maybe that's why it's taking so long.
They do have some serious computers. One of them, they have a couple of nicknames. One of them that is used heavily, it's called Big Ben. It's a crazy XT3 MPP system.
Oh, crazy.
With a peak, nice. Yeah, with a peak of a peak teraflops, 10 teraflops, which is a lot of calculations. And needless to say, I mean, we can ramble on. Another thing, they have an HP Alpha cluster that's being used. It's a cluster of more than 3,000 processors, and it has a peak speed of 6 teraflops. You actually see a lot of it is because remember, there's a lot of universities and government agencies, rather than buying a whole bunch of new hardware or buying a brand new supercomputer, they're just taking a bunch of normal computers and putting them in clusters. It makes life a lot easier and cheaper.
Yeah, that was the entire point of the Virginia Tech XServe cluster when they actually came out with all new G4s or G5s? I forget now. I think it was G4s. I think it was like pre-G5. But when they came out with all that stuff, they tossed them all together and made a giant supercomputer cluster out of it. And actually, it looks very, very cool. But,
probably gets hot.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I mean, but clusters in itself are just incredibly easy to set up. I mean, I remember when I, you know, stumbled right upon the Beowulf clusters back in the day, like 2000. And we had like a bunch of old 486s set up, sitting there gathering dust, waiting to be thrown out at work. So I wired them all up, put them on the Ethernet hub, you know, installed all the Beowulf patches on there, and they purred like kittens. And I was able to crack RC5 keys on them at an amazingly fast rate. But yes, clusters are like very, very powerful and very easy to set up.
And it's perfect. You know, a lot of the people in this field, they do have the money to buy the crazy computers. You know, the true supercomputers where, you know, it's got all the bells and whistles and it's, you know, $500,000 or more. But, I mean, a lot of the research, it's all research. A lot of it is all being done from universities where, you know, if you're going to get that big grant, you don't want to spend it all on computers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that we all know the biologists are very cheap.
I wasn't aware of that stereotype.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. You see, because biologists, they don't want to admit it, but we know. We know that biologists are cheap.
Meanwhile.
I mean, how many biologists do you know that are driving Rolls Royces?
I don't know if that's them being cheap. It's just them being underpaid.
Anyway.
So, yeah, this is turning into a clunker of an episode. You want to just cut it here?
No, not really. I think we're doing actually pretty well. So, okay, so we talked about Big Ben, and, all these computers just do is they just, like, you know, try to redo all these, like, gene sequences and gene mapping, and basically they've been doing this for 5 years and they're still not done yet?
Well, actually, it could take, what a lot of the computers are doing, it's not that they're sequencing, the actual computers are doing all this sequencing. They do actually have machines that are used in order to sequence DNA. They have special machines for it. We can get into the whole process of the polymerase chain reaction for duplicating DNA. It's not really necessary. But what most of these actual computers are doing is they're handling just the load of people searching the database. Because you think about all the load that's going to go in, because you have this 1 gigabit database that people are doing, you know, more or less like searches through the entire thing. And you have the entire research community doing these queries. You know, actually, the way GenBank works is it actually doesn't do your query as soon as you make it. It puts it in line, and it'll reload when your turn in line has come up. And that's one of the ways that they do their load balancing, you know, because it's a lot of information to process. Of course, there are some things that you can do entirely in the computer world, such as, you know, some of the protein folding, but that has to be validated and you know, all the theories of how the computer program is working has to be proven to be the way things exist in the real world. Because we all know, you know, academic and theory versus, you know, actuality is never a hand-to-hand or an exact same transition.
So wait, you kind of mentioned this in passing, but, like, for example, when I'm doing something like protein folding or I'm doing, like, something of folding at home, I'm doing it, but someone actually has to re-verify my work?
They don't have to re-verify every single calculation that you do, but as a good researcher, you can't just blindly accept data.
Yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense in the actual long run, but that does kind of hurt my feelings, like they don't trust me.
I'm honest.
I'm a Boy Scout.
Yeah, and it's not all like they're not going to have to go ahead and recheck the way that the protein is folding and check the chaperone molecules and et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're just going to test the interactions and make sure that things are behaving the way they should.
Wait a minute, there's such thing called chaperone molecules?
Oh, chaperone proteins, they help proteins fold. They're also called heat shock proteins, which is another emerging technology in cancer treatments.
God damn, I always liked biology back in high school, but I never actually got into it, and I really kind of miss that now. And actually, the entire world has kind of blown me by from high school biology, and we're talking about highly advanced stuff here. But anyway, so we also have a note of some other database on here called ChemFinder.
What ChemFinder is it's not truly bioinformatics. It's a lot more of just a great database that's being used a lot in the field of chemistry. What it is it's basically a huge suppository. What? A huge depository. A huge depository for information about various chemicals, various substances. You know, it includes a lot of the vital statistics like boiling point, melting point, vapor pressure, et cetera, et cetera. But that's done by Cambridge Soft. And what's nice about them is they actually give you, you can do 5 free searches without registering, and then you have to register, but you can keep doing searches. And for anybody who's listening and is in school and has a chemistry class where you have to do lab write-ups and et cetera, this is an excellent resource for that sort of thing.
Jeez, the internet's making the kids these days soft. I mean, I remember having to do all this shit in books, looking it up like, oh, look at that, the specific gravity of this material is a whole lot bigger.
Well, they don't give you all the answers.
Why don't you just go to ChemFinder and find all this crazy shit online automatically? Back in my day,
when I was your age,
walk uphill both ways.
Uphill both ways in the snow.
In the middle of the summer.
Had to slaughter an animal on my way to school to have lunch.
Without
there.
Shoes.
Yes.
On
shoes? I didn't even have feet.
All the way on a road made entirely of razor blades.
Yes, and I enjoyed it.
And then afterwards, walked through the rubbing alcohol river.
All right. So, I mean, this, we kind of, like, really basically glossed over a lot of stuff here. I mean, this is a very intense field, and, I mean, we're not going to be able to cover all the stuff in one night, but I think we did kind of cover a lot of the basics and what bioinformatics is and how you can actually use all this stuff and why it actually be as interesting to some people. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there when we're talking about, you know, chaperone proteins and, you know, specific densities, specific gravity and all that kind of stuff and RNA, DNA, and I'm sure there are a lot of people just sleeping right now, but hey, screw you all. No.
It's a nice thing to think about for a career. You know, if you're somebody who's really interested in computers and you're also really interested in biology, it's something to consider because you get a chance to work with medicine, you get to help people with what you're doing, and you know, and you get to handle some really, really nice computers and do a lot of data crunching.
If you like data crunching, this seems to be the field for you. And actually, I did, before I left work today, I actually set up to download that bootable CD, and I am going to try and play with it and see what the hell I can do with it. But, it's interesting, and it just seems to be like massive data. And I do enjoy just, you know, crunching massive databases for some reason. I'm a sick, sad person like that. I mean, look at me. I keep a database of payphones. But it's just... It's fun to crunch numbers, in my opinion. And this is, if you do enjoy this sort of thing, I think this is going to be a very interesting way of interesting things for you to do. So, and I didn't mean screw you all. Please, you know, tune in next week. We love you, listeners. All that stuff. Look at that. I'm Strom dropping off on me. I'm insulting all of our listener base.
Yeah.
Anyway, announcements. Strom, do you have announcements?
Layer 1, 2.5 weeks from now. Layer1.info. Yes.
Oh.
I'm talking. Come see my awesome talk.
What weekend is that?
That's Tax Day weekend, April 15th and 16th.
Tax Day weekend? Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the weekend before that, if you want to head over to Ohio, Nauticon is coming, and that's in Cleveland. You see beautiful downtown Cleveland. Droops is presenting. I think Droops is presenting, isn't he? Yeah.
I think he's been also with Ponyboy.
Yeah, Droops, Ponyboy, Nightlord, a lot of the Infonomicon crew over there on Pound Infonomicon on irc.freenode.net. So head on over there, show your support, and it seems to be a very interesting thing. It's not specifically a hacker convention, from what I can tell. There's far too many girls in the pictures. But, other than that, I mean, it seems pretty cool. They actually have something. One of the contests they had was transmit data over anything you can. I don't know what the exact title is, but you know, you use your most interesting creation to transmit data, and you get points. Because you know, Ethernet isn't everything. I think there's your tagline.
Bring back the string and can.
They actually do that. If you do something with a string and can, you get 10 points.
I wonder if you could do... see, now I have to go just so I can do that.
It'd be very interesting. I actually think it'd be cool to, like, you know, set up some type of flashlight Morse code system.
That'd be pretty sweet.
It wouldn't be hard.
I'm sure it wouldn't be. I guess we're going to shout. Shouts? Who has shouts?
Shouts to everybody. Shouts to everybody in IRC and everybody who's always helping me with all my code rage, especially Ali, A-A-L-I, in IRC. He's been a big help with a lot of the code that's been going through. So a special thank you to that fine gentleman.
Yes, Ali is a nice person, and he always seems to be very helpful for Dr. Zygmunt and his rants and raves. I'll send shouts out. Oh, you know, another announcement. I guess we're kind of going back to here. Linux World. Yeah, announcements. Linux World is coming up in Boston. I believe you can actually still get in free if you sign up now. However, the clock is ticking, and I believe it will end this week as the free sign up. But I'll be there. Various people from Boston 2600 will be there. Hey, just stop on by, and if you're going to be in the area, just give me a ring or something, or, you know, email me, actually, because all my phone's messed up, because Asterisk is sucking. Shouts to Dr. Zygmunter for coming up on this topic with kind of short notice, because, boy, when you're getting married, your weekends really start going downhill very, very quick.
Yeah.
Site of the week, Kyle L. posted this in IRC today, and I was morbidly fascinated by it. It's called www.mydeathspace.com, and it's people who have died in their MySpaces.
And mydeathspace.com?
Yeah, it's
pretty sweet.
It's a lot like a car wreck. You're looking at it, and you're kind of, like, disgusted by it, but you just can't look away. It's weird. It really is. It's kind of eerie. Email us, radio@binrev.com, or voicemail us at
889-BINREV.
Same number,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
889-BINREV. So leave us a voicemail, give us a call. We actually did have a voicemail box for a while, and I think one person used it. But hey, you know, if you're too lazy or it's 2 a.m., you're not wearing any pants, and you're thinking of us, hey, just give us a call, you know, and leave us a voicemail.
Yeah.
We have closing music tonight. Our closing music tonight is the Zelda 64 Orkiana. I can always mispronounce this. Orkina?
Ocarina.
Ocarina.
Hey, Ocarina. I think I made that joke last time.
Yeah.
Ocarina of Time. Prayer.
Nice.
The Ocarina of Time what?
Prayer.
Ah, okay.
It had a nice beat. I kind of liked it.
Cool.
It sounded nice.
You should get the Boolean of Fire next time.
Yeah. So, next week, hopefully, you know, we won't have all these issues, and we'll actually have, like, you know, an episode that doesn't suck as bad.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you next week. Same hack
same
time.
Same hack channel. Oh,
Yeah.